Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, this is show 52, so I'm going to take that as the one-year anniversary of Just for the Health of It. Woohoo! Okay. Well, we're going to start off with a few stories about the coronavirus epidemic slash pandemic that's happening right now. Let's start off from the Washington Post. As coronavirus spreads, the bill for our public health failures is due. This is from Dr. Richard Besser, a physician and the president and chief executive of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. In spring 2009, the H1N1 influenza virus surfaced in Mexico, swiftly evolving from outbreak to pandemic in just 2 months. As acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at the time, I led our work to issue preliminary warnings and evidence-based recommendations to help Americans reduce their risk of infection, very similar to what you're hearing about COVID-19 today. Schools were of particular interest given the role children can play in amplifying infectious disease transmission. To reduce that likelihood, our initial recommendation was that officials close schools for 2 weeks following their first confirmed H1N1 case. The thought was, keep kids at home, reduce transmission risk, part of an approach called social distancing. Your recommendations are nuts, said David Fleming, the head of public health in Seattle and King County. Social distancing wasn't happening, he said. Parents without sick leave or affordable child care options were forced to drop their kids at malls, libraries, or community centers rather than leave them unsupervised at home. In essence, the CDC had failed to consider what millions of Americans couldn't comply even if they wanted to. What happens, for example, to the millions of children who get breakfast and lunch through programs at school if we close them? Crises such as H1N1 and COVID-19 provide a mirror for our society and the actions we take, or fail to take. Today, the United States is in that mirror is one in which the risk of exposure and the ability to protect oneself and one's family depends on income, access to health care, and immigration status, among other factors. The failures of public policy and imagination have been stalking us for years, creating haves and have-nots, parents who don't have paid sick leave from work, only 10 states and the District of Columbia mandate it, a lack of affordable child care or sick child care, and at least 28 million Americans living without insurance, and nearly one-third of the population still underinsured, health protections that are not distributed evenly from region to region, and fear among undocumented immigrants regarding access to care. Even when structural failures could imperil every American, the greatest strains will fall on certain demographics because of their economic, social, or health status. The elderly and disabled are at particular risk when their daily lives and support systems are disrupted. Those without easy access to health care, including rural and native communities, might face daunting distances at times of need. People living in close quarters, whether in public housing, nursing homes, jails, shelters, or even the homeless on the streets, might suffer in waves, as we have already seen in Washington State. And the vulnerabilities of the low-wage gig economy, with non-salaried workers and precarious work schedules, will be exposed to for all to see during this crisis. Ask the 60% of the U.S. labor force that is paid hourly how easy it is to take time off in a moment of need. The CDC is an evidence-based public health agency. But if the evidence used to make recommendations does not incorporate these health equity issues, we will fall short. The nation will not be prepared to weather what is becoming a pandemic. If systems and tactics that can help to control the spread of COVID-19, such as paid sick days, shown to reduce the spread of flu in jurisdictions where they are mandated, are not available to every American, CDC recommendations are, effectively, words that cannot be implemented. Our nation's predicament today is both tragic, because so many people will likely suffer, and maddening because it doesn't have to be this way. In the short term, the United States must play the hand that we've been dealt with. Indeed, there is no short-term solutions to our long-term neglects. The underlying work our nation must do to ensure all people in the United States have a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being, sick leave, universal health care, quality child care, and early education, as well as fair immigration policies, must be done in moments of calm. In the meantime, we could also consider a fund to compensate hourly workers without paid leave for their loss of income when sick, provide legal aid for those who are fired for not coming to work when ill, fund outreach to non-English speakers, ask insurers to waive co-pays for testing and treatment, supplement funding for community health centers that care for a large proportion of those without insurance, and ensure free meals are available for children when schools are closed. We don't know how the COVID-19 story will end, but even before the ending is written, we know its lessons. Every long-term solution must be viewed through the health equity lens, for if they are not, we'll be setting the stage for our next public health failure. To quote a friend, that's just nuts. Okay, well, this show is recorded, so it's going to be in this rapidly emerging epidemic. Probably the best thing I can say is that when I look at the map of new cases, it looks like the United States is getting a case of chickenpox showing up all over the place. So it's coming. Okay, but let's stick to this theme of the coronavirus and its impact and elucidation or manifesting the weaknesses in our public health system or our social fabric. For one example, this from The Hill. Coronavirus testing could cost some patients extra. The Trump administration's effort to scale up coronavirus testing in the U.S. could leave some patients with unexpected medical bills. The federal government will rely heavily on commercial labs to run the vast majority of coronavirus tests. Those labs, along with hospitals and academic institutions, could bill patients and their insurance companies for testing. How much each patient pays will ultimately depend on whether they have insurance, what kind of plan they have, and whether it requires cost-sharing, like deductibles and co-pays. We have a patchwork quilt that's full of holes. That's our healthcare system, and it's not well-designed for dealing with a public health crisis like this one, said Sabrina Corlett, a research professor at Georgetown University. While lab tests completed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and public health labs are free to patients, those tests make up a small fraction of the testing that will be done for the coronavirus. People without insurance might face out-of-pocket expenses for testing if it's conducted by a commercial lab. People with high-deductible plans, which require patients spend a certain amount toward care before coverage kicks in, could also be hit with testing costs. Studies have found that high-deductible health plans are linked to delayed diagnoses. The average deductible in an employer-based plan is about $1,650, while an Obamacare bronze plan is about $6,000. Those financial burdens could lead some people to forego testing, potentially leading to further spread of the virus, experts said. As testing moves out of the public health sphere and into the private healthcare and insurance market, there are more avenues for unintended consequences, said Adrian Casaletti, Chief of Government Affairs for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Co-pays and deductibles are there to make you think twice about using health services, but we don't want people to hesitate when it comes to public health. It's not yet clear how much the commercial tests will cost, but it's likely they will vary. Patients who are tested for the coronavirus might also face costs related to visiting a doctor, emergency room, or urgent care. If they test positive and require hospitalization, they would face charges for that too. Governors in New York, Washington, California issued guidance prohibiting health insurers from imposing cost sharing on individuals seeking coronavirus tests, but all states are limited in what they can require of self-funded plans typically offered by large employers. More than 60% of people who get insurance through work are in these type of plans. While employers can't be required to cover the tests, Tolbert noted they might feel compelled to do so to prevent diseases from spreading in the workplace. Okay, so let's rely on the good-heartedness of health insurers. That's a good plan. Okay, next up, from the Atlantic, It's an exclusive. They did a lot of research, and I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs or so from this article, but about the botching of the rolling out of testing. So this is an exclusive from The Atlantic. The strongest evidence yet that America is botching coronavirus testing. The figures we gathered suggest that the American response to the coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19, has been shockingly sluggish, especially compared with that of other developed countries. The CDC confirmed 8 days ago that the virus was in community transmission in the United States, that it was infecting Americans who had neither traveled abroad nor were in contact with others who had. In South Korea, more than 66,650 people were tested within a week of its first case of community transmission, and it quickly became able to test 10,000 people a day. The United Kingdom, which has only 115 positive cases, has so far tested 18,000 people for the virus. Our reporting found that the capacity to test for the coronavirus varies dramatically, and sometimes dangerously, from state to state. More than a week after the country's first case of community transmission, the most significant finding about the coronavirus's spread in the United States has come from an independent genetic study, not from field data collected by the government, and no city or state has banned large gatherings or implemented the type of aggressive social distancing policies employed to battle the virus in Italy, Hong Kong, and other affluent places. If the true extent of the outbreak were known through testing, the American situation would look worse, but healthcare officials and providers would be better positioned to combat the virus. Hard decisions require data. For now, state and local governments don't have the information they need. Okay, so we're kind of behind the curve. But another story to get at the example of the fact that our social fabric has a lot of weak points, and this is particularly critical and critically a problem when you have infectious diseases. So this is from The Verge. Prisons and jails are vulnerable to COVID-19 outbreaks. Last week, a person incarcerated in King County Jail in downtown Seattle was taken to the hospital after they were suspected of having the new coronavirus. The county says there are no cases currently in the jail, but the new virus remains a huge concern for correctional facilities, particularly in outbreak hotspots like King County. With 85 confirmed cases of COVID-19, the illness caused by the virus, the county is home to the largest known hotspot of cases of the new coronavirus in the United States. It's only a matter of time before the novel coronavirus enters a U.S. jail or prisons, says Tyler Winkleman, co-director of the Health, Homeless, and Criminal Justice Lab at the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute in Minneapolis. All prisons and jails should anticipate that the coronavirus will enter their facility, and they need to have plans for monitoring and treating anyone who has symptoms, he says. People regularly cycle in and out of jails and prisons. People who work in them leave and return daily, and visitors regularly stream through. Viruses of all kinds have multiple entry points, and those that enter tend to spread fast. Outbreaks of the flu regularly occur in these facilities, and during the H1N1 epidemic in 2009, many jails and prisons dealt with high numbers of cases. We know the coronavirus spreads quickly in closed spaces, like cruise ships, nursing homes, and jails and prisons. Many people who are incarcerated also have chronic conditions like diabetes or HIV, which makes them vulnerable to severe forms of COVID-19. One way to reduce the impact of the virus on jails and prisons, Winkleman says, is to avoid holding people for low-level offenses. In Iran, officials temporarily released tens of thousands of people determined to not be at risk to the public from prisons in an effort to stop the spread of the virus. People who aren't at risk to public safety shouldn't be held in a jail just because they're not able to pay a bond, he says. We are increasing their health risk by keeping them, he says. This is a time to make sure we have as few people at risk as possible. In Sonoma County, California, the jail is screening people at booking for symptoms and asking them about their travel history and contact with people who may be sick. Those type of screenings are critical, Winkleman says. It is essential that correctional staff are working with officials to make sure no one ill is entering a facility. Some jails and prisons in the U.S. may be prepared to screen, monitor, and treat people suspected of having COVID-19, but others are far from equipped to handle it. Healthcare centers and correctional facilities are often substandard and understaffed, which may mean people held in them aren't monitored regularly enough. Symptoms need to be addressed quickly, not once a week or twice a week, Winkleman says. Isolating people suspected of having the virus could also be a challenge in some facilities. The Hennepin County Jail has 4 isolation rooms and set up some spaces for quarantines, but other places might not have the same capabilities, he says. Homer Venters, former chief medical officer of the New York City jail system, wrote in The Hill that jails and prisons need to prepare now. They need to have a plan in place to identify and house together people with suspected and diagnosed COVID-19 and those who are at high risk of serious illness if they become infected. Many facilities struggle to do so during the outbreaks of H1N1, he said, because jails typically house people based on the level of security they need, not their health status. Standard public health interventions like flu shots are even more important during disease outbreaks. If fewer people get the flu, they can stay out of healthcare facilities and leave more resources available for those who really need it. We don't want there to be outbreaks of multiple illnesses at once, Winkleman says. Many jails and prisons, though, don't regularly provide flu shots. Over half of U.S. jails did not receive H1N1 vaccines when they became available. Under 10% of people in Maine correctional facilities received flu shots in 2011, which contributed to outbreaks. People in jails and prisons may also not be able to regularly wash their hands, which may promote the spread of disease. Hand sanitizer, which contains alcohol, is usually considered contraband. COVID-19 outbreaks in and around jails and prisons don't just have health impacts for people within the justice system. If public health officials recommend that courts not meet during outbreaks, people might be held for longer than necessary. It might be challenging for people in probation to meet with supervisors or fulfill community supervision requirements if there are restrictions on movement in an area. It may also mean that there would be less programming and movement within a facility. Likely, at some point, visiting would be shut down. That can increase isolation and anxiety during a period of incarceration. Vulnerable communities, like people held in prisons and jails, are often most at risk during public health emergencies. They have fewer protections from an outbreak and may face more significant fallout from many disruptions in daily life. But protecting communities from infectious disease means protecting everyone, including those who aren't able to protect themselves. Jail and prison healthcare is public health. It's community health, Winkleman says. Okay, and just for a little context, want to look at institutionalized populations because knowing that the COVID-19 virus spreads in these confined spaces, particularly when people will have other health vulnerabilities, it makes it even more dastardly. So let's compare it to hospitals and nursing homes with mass incarcerated populations. So there's about 600,000 people at any given time in about 6,000 hospitals. Now, the capacity for total hospital beds is just under a million in the U.S. In nursing homes, there are 1.3 million in about 16,000 nursing homes. So that's just under 2 million people that are in hospitals or nursing homes, people that would be vulnerable to health that are gathered together in confined spaces where transmission might be easier. Okay, for the incarcerated population, there's 2.3 million people in about 7,000 facilities. So, and this is more concentrated than the other institutionalized populations of nursing homes and hospitals, and a larger total number of people. And hospitals and nursing homes are specifically designed to deal with infectious disease. Now, you can argue about how well they do that. There are a lot of problems. And in fact, nosocomial infections, that's infections that are gained and acquired through being in a hospital, is actually a leading cause of death in this country. So it's very difficult to control infectious disease, even in hospital settings that are geared up and paying attention to that. But if you're looking at an understaffed, underfunded, undervalued population like those incarcerated, you're ripe for transmission. And again, it isn't just the people that are locked up that are going to be a problem. It's going to be guards and staff, which are going and coming back in the community, and jails and prisons can be massively affected themselves and be points of the virus spreading throughout the community. Okay, well, that does it for the coronavirus update today. There will be more to come on that, certainly. But let's go now to the regular public health news and policy roundup, where I gather all the wonderful non-coronavirus news that there is in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
So this from Health Policy News. Ohio ranks at bottom in new national drug trend report. Ohio and Kentucky lead the nation in three drug use trends that make it clear that the region remains in an addiction epidemic. A newly released analysis of Millennium Health patient drug testing results show Ohio is the top state for co-occurring fentanyl and meth use, with Kentucky second. Kentucky is first for co-occurring fentanyl and cocaine use, with Ohio just a fraction behind it. And Kentucky is a state with the most drug use tests that are positive for fentanyl alone, with Ohio ranking second. Okay, next up from Science Daily, air pollution is one of the world's most dangerous health risks. Polluted air is a public health hazard that cannot be evaded. It is widely known that long-term exposure to air pollution enhances the risk of cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. Scientists from the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry and the University Medical Center, Mainz, now calculated in a new study that the global public loss of life expectancy caused by air pollution is higher than many other risk factors such as smoking, infectious diseases, or violence. Air pollution caused 8.8 million premature deaths worldwide in 2015. This corresponds to an average reduction in life expectancy per capita of 2.9 years. In comparison, tobacco smoking reduces the life expectancy by an average of 2.2 years, HIV/AIDS by 0.7 years, parasitic and vector-borne diseases such as malaria by 0.6 years. Air pollution exceeds malaria as a cause of premature death by a factor of 19. It exceeds violence by a factor of 17 and HIV/AIDS by a factor of 9. Given the huge impact on public health and the global population, one could say that our results indicate an air pollution pandemic, says Jos Liefeld, director of the Max Planck Institute of Chemistry and first author of the study. This study is the first to examine the global impact of air pollution on human health compared to other risk factors worldwide. Our comparison of different global risk factors shows that ambient air pollution is a leading cause of premature mortality and loss of life expectancy, in particular through cardiovascular diseases. According to the findings of the study, almost two-thirds of the deaths caused by air pollution, namely around 5.5 million a year, are avoidable, and the majority of polluted air comes from the use of fossil fuels. The researchers estimate that the average life expectancy worldwide would increase by more than a year if emissions from the use of fossil fuels were limited. Well, add that to the list of moving to renewable energy sources. Okay, next up, very interesting story from DW.com. Climate change leads to more violence against women, girls. Natoya Sande was 13 years old when she got married against her will. "I was sent to be married because of a shortage of food in the house," she said. Her parents used to have a small piece of land, but floods wiped out their harvest. "I tried to negotiate to tell my parents that I wasn't ready, that I didn't want to get married, but they told me I had to because that would mean one mouth less at the table." Her story is one of thousands of cases highlighted in a recent study from the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN. 2 years in the making, the report is the largest and most comprehensive study to date on the effect of climate change and environmental degradation on gender-based violence. This study shows us that the damage humanity is inflicting on nature can also fuel violence against women around the world, a link that has so far been largely overlooked. This study adds to the urgency of halting environmental degradation alongside action to stop gender-based violence in all its forms, and demonstrates that the two issues often need to be addressed together. Malawi isn't the only place where minors are being married against their will to help their families survive climate disasters. According to the study, girls in Ethiopia and South Sudan are being sold off in marriage during extreme droughts in exchange for cattle. Julian Schmucker, the regional director for Asia at humanitarian organization Plan International, said the rate of food and forced marriages demonstrably increases in crisis situations. "It's simply a survival strategy. To get rid of a daughter to relieve the pressure on the family. It's the only way to generate income." Growing resource scarcity also increased the risk that women and girls will be victims of violence. With increasing drought and desertification in the global south, more and more water sources and wells are drying up. Fetching water is often a woman's job. And if they're forced to walk further for that water, the risk of sexual assault also increases, especially in regions characterized by armed gangs. Walking to collect water can put women in dangerous situations. The same risk applies to gathering firewood, said Dirk Both, spokesman for the international aid organization World Vision. That's why we build wells in the villages directly or nearby and try through reforestation efforts to plant trees near settlements. In addition to practical measures, aid organizations have also called for changes to traditional gender roles. We've seen great success when religious leaders use their influence to make it clear that men have no right to inflict violence against women, said Both. It's also important that girls and women know that they can who they can contact after an assault and that they're encouraged to do so, added Schmucker. Women living on many of Africa's coasts and lakes have also suffered as fish have become scarcer. Fishermen peddling their wares are now not only expecting money as payment, they're also demanding sex. This practice is now so common in western Kenya that it has a name, the Jiboia system. World Vision has tried to counteract this form of sexual exploitation, in particular in the eastern African region around Lake Victoria, where women have been given the opportunity to breed fish in ponds. This way they can now set their own businesses and sell fish without getting into violent situations. With fish scarce, some fishermen in Kenya now expect sex in addition to money. Fish ponds can provide women with a means of generating their own income. Both World Vision and Plant International also confirmed another of the study's observations. In places where women are responsible for agriculture, a sudden natural disaster or extreme weather event can have a dramatic effect on their social and family standing. If harvests are threatened or wiped out altogether, this can lead to violence, often from within their own families. Diversifying their sources of income is the most important way to protect women, said Schmucker. If we help women to adapt to climate change and improve their income situation, everyone benefits, including children and men, said Both. In Bangladesh, many women prefer to ride out natural disasters in their homes rather than emergency shelters. Women and girls can suffer terribly in extreme weather situations and during natural disasters, when societies dictate certain behaviors and prohibit others, such as being out in public alone. Women are also more likely to die as a result of flooding in Bangladesh, said Gotland Aber of the Gender Equality Network Women for Climate Justice, because they rarely seek refuge in emergency shelters. These shelters are very cramped, and for Bangladeshi women, it is not appropriate to stand there face-to-face with men or to use the same toilet, she said. That's why most women prefer to barricade themselves in their huts, where they are often simply washed away by the floods. But men also die because of these traditional societal roles, Albert continued. In Australia, men are much more likely to commit suicide than women if they lose their land or their job, she said. Men receive significantly less help than women in crisis situations, which is primarily related to the traditional view of masculinity. Honduran rights activist Berta Caceres was shot and killed inside her home after leading a movement against a dam project. Environmental crimes such as poaching and illegal resource extraction can also lead to gender-based violence. According to the IUCN study, threats and sexual violence such as rape are often used to target environmental activists to undermine their status within the community and to prevent other women from working to preserve the environment from the construction of a new mine or dam, for example. Similar strategies are also used in industrialized nations, as women who work on environmental issues are threatened with rape on social media in order to intimidate and silence them. The issue of gender and climate has, however, been a prominent feature of UN climate conferences since 2012. At the most recent summit in Madrid in December, participating states agreed on the second Gender Action Plan, with the goal to put women on an equal footing on all levels of climate policy, in institutions, but also on individual climate protection projects. The aim is to reduce structural gender inequalities around the world. These inequalities also exist in Western industrialized societies, explained Alber. She referred to Germany's Climate Protection Act, which plans to introduce higher CO2 prices in the coming years, increases which will especially affect poorer people. That includes many retirees and single parents, most of whom are women. According to Alber, if climate protection in Germany is to be equal for both genders, the government has to offer a better compensation than a simple commuter tax relief scheme. Okay. Wow, that's an interesting story. And just to kind of sum that up, I would like to point out that actually the number one driver of development in the third world, and you could argue the entire world, is, here it comes, improving the status of women. And this is doubly true for health and public health, as women tend to be the caretakers in both healthcare settings and in family situations as far as home. So let's all do whatever we can to improve the status of women here and around the world. Okay, let's close out today's show with a report from The Independent. Every country on Earth failing to provide World Fit for Children, Landmark Report warns. Every country in the world is failing to protect children's health, their environment, and their futures, a Landmark Report for the World Health Organization has found. The damning findings pull back the curtain on an increasingly fragile world in which unbridled industrialism is already sabotaging the lives of younger generations. The report, based on a commission of more than 40 child and adolescent health experts from around the world, said every child on Earth is now under immediate threat from ecological degradation, climate change, and exploitive marketing practices that push heavily processed fast food, sugary drinks, alcohol, and tobacco at children. Despite improvements in child and adolescent health over the past 20 years, progress has stalled and is set to reverse, said Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and the co-chair of the commission. The report by the World Health Organization, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the Lancet Commission ranked 180 countries on conditions they provide for a child to thrive and survive. Despite its wealth, the U.S. performed badly in the rankings, listed as only the 39th best place for children. I'm going to repeat that. The U.S. performed badly in the rankings, listed as only the 39th best place for children. The report said while wealthier countries generally have better health and development outcomes, it is them in particular who threaten the future of all children through carbon pollution, on course to cause runaway climate change and environmental disaster. It has been estimated that around 250 million children under 5 years old in low and middle income countries are at risk of not reaching their development potential based on proxy measures of stunting and poverty. But of even greater concern, every child worldwide now faces existential threats from climate change and commercial pressures. Evidence suggests that children in some countries see as many as 30,000 advertisements on television alone in a single year, the report warns. Exposure to the predatory marketing of unhealthy junk food and sugary drinks is directly linked to the purchase of unhealthy food and drinks, which have fueled health problems, including the alarming rise in childhood obesity. The number of obese children and adolescents around the world increased from 11 million in 1975 to 124 million in 2016, an 11-fold increase, with dire individual and societal costs. Henrietta Fore, UNICEF's executive director, said, "From the climate crisis to obesity and harmful commercial marketing, children around the world are having to contend with threats that were unimaginable just a few generations ago."
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning. Use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, that does it for our show today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to review this show, any previous show, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/wakt. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always." And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.